at the letters. Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
And the 2-2 pitch, popped up foul, playable. The first baseman, Santana, over. He's under in front of his dugout. He has it, and Cleveland wins it 3-0, and they're going to their first World Series since 1997.
We're in good position throughout that whole series. It really came down to that they shut down our offense. Our pitching staff and our bullpen pitched very well. As they did their job. We just couldn't come up with a big hit or really mount any kind of offense or sustain anything.
It's at the letters for Thursday, October 20th on sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. My name is Arden Zwelling. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Ben, it's all over.
It's over.
It's all over. Yeah. What happens now?
Well,
is there not a game to go to tonight or tomorrow night, or there isn't like a flight to catch? Or there, yeah. What do I do with my life now? I don't understand.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
It's what do I do? It's like sleep?
I mean, you sound a little sick.
How do people do that?
You could probably use use a few days of recovery here.
Both mentally and physically, yeah. I am falling apart. As you know, I've been like fighting this sickness since Cleveland. And so I swear, last night, as soon as the final out was made, it was like my body just knew that it was over and was like, unleash hell.
Yeah, I saw the moment of collapse in the Blue Jays clubhouse and you just broke out into a kind of a fever.
Having a legit fever in the Jays clubhouse waiting for Troy Tulowitzki.
Oh, the wait continued. It was a long wait.
And we're still waiting now.
Yeah.
We're still waiting now.
Still wonder what Tulowitzki thinks about the Jays season, but we don't know.
You know what? I bet you that they battled. I bet you that, you know, he really believes in every guy in there.
Yeah.
I bet you he'd go to war with these guys.
I think that...
I bet you he hopes that everyone's back.
He's the kind of guy, though, who sometimes, as much as he can, you know, say the predictable baseball player things on occasion, there are other times when he has really good insights on the team.
I was so looking to talk to him after last night's game because, like, he gave me amazing stuff after game 6 in Kansas City last year.
Right.
Like, he was phenomenal, and he opened up, and like we had a conversation unlike a conversation we've ever had before. So that's why I really want to talk to him. And yet,
didn't happen.
Who knows? Hey, you know, you don't always get what you want in life. Blue Jays fans certainly didn't get what they wanted. A 4-1 loss in the ALCS in a series that I would argue was a lot closer than the 4-1 line suggests.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the pitching was really good on both sides. And the difference essentially was a few home runs by Cleveland.
It kind of depends on like how you look at the world. Like, was it either a really, really well-pitched series or was it a spectacularly poorly hit series? You know what I mean? Like, was the hitting really bad or was the pitching really good? I tend to go with the pitching was just that good. But you can make a case that like Cleveland didn't hit a thing in this series.
Yeah, we've seen that from a lot of Blue Jays opponents this year just because their pitching's been so good. So I'm willing to give the Blue Jays starters credit. I'm willing to give Corey Kluber credit. And, I mean, of course, you're giving Andrew Miller credit and Cleveland's bullpen. I think he'll be fine.
Sorry.
But, I think that with guys like Josh Tomlin and Ryan Merritt, that's a case where the Jays should have hit them.
Ryan, I'm still, like, I can't believe what happened with Ryan Merritt. Like, I was, like, as it was happening, I was in disbelief. And then, like, after the game, like I looked at, you know, his where he was throwing the pitches and what he was throwing. Like, went back, looked at. He attacked the zone, like just absolutely attacked Blue Jays hitters with an 87-mile-an-hour fastball.
Yeah.
And that was like the height was 87. Like, how awesome. We were like in the clubhouse, like Darren Barney was joking around. Like, you know, I think I threw harder than that when I pitched earlier this year. Like, it was crazy. And then, you know what? He had a really nice curveball. He threw a few good changeups. But really, like, it was pretty ordinary stuff, and he was in the zone, and the Blue Jays couldn't do anything with it.
Yeah, it was Burley-esque, you know, to go out there without a lot of stuff and somehow get results. I mean, he, and especially in the context of the shaking in his boots comment that Jose Bautista made, he pitched really well,
He did look exceptionally nervous. Like, he's a twitchy guy, right? Like, you know, he'd do, like, a lot of, like, just, like, I guess twitchiness is really the best word for it. Somehow it worked.
Yeah. So that's a case where I think the Blue Jays hitters should have done more. I think that, you know, the full season says that this is a good offensive team. And we certainly saw it in the early part of the playoffs. And you know, it just, for whatever reason, it just didn't happen in the ALCS, and give Cleveland credit, but I think there were some chances there for the Blue Jays against those pitchers, and they couldn't make it happen.
It was kind of like the season in a nutshell. It's kind of a microcosm of this offense, which was just so inconsistent, I would say. Because you look at the aggregate, you look at how they performed over a six-month sample, and, you know, top 10 offense in baseball, like, you know, still really good, like, hit a ton of home runs. Like, I don't know how many 20-homer guys they had, but probably,
six.
Yeah, they had six, right? And then, but the thing is, like, you kind of line up six right-handed power bats in a row, and there's going to be some nights where you look unstoppable, and then there's going to be some, because everybody's clicking, and there's going to be some nights where only if, you know, one or two or three of them are clicking, and so you're in the ballgame. And there's some nights where they're all cold, because they all kind of do the same thing, and you look completely impotent, right? And so I thought that's kind of, you know, that's what happened in this series, is they just couldn't get everybody clicking.
Yeah, that's probably fair. You know, they had a lot of trouble really getting much of anything going. And Michael Saunders had a good series. We saw glimpses of offense from other guys. Josh Donaldson, you know, had a great game four on both sides of the ball. But just overall, you weren't seeing the walks that you'd normally see. At least that's my anecdotal impression of having watched this series, is I didn't see them walking and just kind of forcing,
that's fair.
You know, creating rallies with walks. I certainly didn't see them creating rallies with a lot of hits, and the home runs weren't there. So, I mean, basically any element that you'd look for offensively, they couldn't deliver.
No, that's absolutely fair. Jose Bautista walked, who is probably the best walker of the Toronto Blue Jays, walked three times in the series.
Yeah.
That's low for him. We've seen games where he walks four times in a game, right? And he only walked three times. I think Russell Martin, he even came out and said, like, I need to take my walks right now.
Yeah.
Because he straight wasn't. He didn't get a walk until the last game, I believe. I think he walked, and he had that little blooper that fell in. You know, Edwin Encarnacion, one walk in five games, you know. Even Josh Donaldson, two walks in five games. Like, that's pretty strange.
Yeah.
It's pretty odd.
And in Martin's case in particular, the walks were kind of all you were going to get, just because he didn't seem to be at his best physically. So you're probably not going to see, you know, a lot of ringing doubles off the wall.
Yeah. You know, and you kind of balance how much the beat-upness played a factor, because, you know, the Blue Jays, clearly Josh Donaldson beat up. Obviously Russell Martin beat up. I think his knee, that injury they suffered when he, you know, passed out in a sauna, I think that was, he never really let on about it, but I think that was something that bothered him a lot over the back half of the season. And even just the workload that Russell Martin withstood this year and last, you know, he's second to Sal Perez, you know, in terms of innings caught. I mean, it's a lot, man. It's a lot of work behind the plate. So, but you balance that with, well, every, you know, Cleveland played 162 games as well.
Yep.
You know, and then they also played three games in the DS. You know, like they went through this stuff also. You know, I don't know. Can it be as simple as Cleveland is a younger team and therefore better prepared to withstand the rigors of a major league season? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think I'd go down that path personally. Yeah. I think the Jays could have won the World Series this year. I believe that. Just they have the talent. I just think that they were outplayed. You know, Cleveland played better than them. And I don't think the Blue Jays are the best team in baseball by any stretch. I mean, that's obvious. That the Cubs are the best team in baseball. But could the Blue Jays have won the World Series? Yeah. I mean, they were, what, seven wins away? They got close again. And it just didn't happen.
So, I mean, did Cleveland significantly outplay the Blue Jays?
Yeah.
I don't know if they significantly did.
Well, you dug up some numbers on this.
I'm setting myself up for this thing I tweeted today that everybody hated, literally without exception.
Our friend Jeff Simmons didn't like it.
Simmons didn't like it at all. Everybody hated this. But hey, they're just stats. That's all I'm giving you. I didn't offer opinions, just stats. Toronto out-hit Cleveland in this series, 32-25. They had a better batting average. Toronto hit 201, Cleveland hit 168. Toronto did a better job of getting on base. Toronto had a 251 on base percentage. Cleveland had a 215 on base percentage. We just, you know, talked about how Toronto didn't walk. They walked 11 times. Cleveland only walked 9 times. Toronto had, you know, comparable start pitching. Cleveland's ERA for the series was 1.43. Toronto's was 2.30. Toronto had a better whip from their pitchers, a 0.791 whip, while Cleveland's whip was 0.977. And yet, Cleveland won four games. Toronto only won one. Right. It was close. The difference was 4 runs.
Yep.
Cleveland scored 4 more runs and won 3 more games. Like, that's significant, I think. Because, like, if these teams play each other 162 times, I feel like somebody would win 82 and somebody would win 80 probably.
Yeah.
Like, they're so evenly matched.
Right. And I agree on that point. And I also think that even in this series, even within these 5 games, they were more evenly matched than the 4-1 would suggest. I mean, on the other hand, it's not a best of 7 of WHIP. It's a best of 7 for wins, and Cleveland won. So, I mean, yeah. But I, you know, point taken, I think it was closer.
I think it was closer. I don't think Cleveland significantly outplayed Toronto. No. I think they won more games.
Yeah. But they did outplay them.
They did outplay them. They hit, I think it just kind of came down to timely hitting, really. Cleveland got some home runs when they really needed them. Toronto didn't. Cleveland won, it basically won on home runs.
Yeah,
really. So it's tough. Like, it's, so I can't like sit here and say, oh, the Blue Jays were flawed. This is always going to happen to them. Like, I agree with you. I think the Blue Jays, if they had been hot, you know, at the right time, could have gone to the World Series and could have won it. You know, like, you can't look at this team that like had a really good offense, top 10 offense, like you talked about, that pitched better than anybody else in the American League, that played, you know, really good defense up the middle, at least. The only defensive positions you're really worried about, your corner outfielders. Otherwise, you got solid defense around the diamond. You can't look at this team and be like, oh, it was flawed. They were never going to win. It's a good team. You know what I mean? Like, it just didn't work in a 5-game sample, really.
Yeah. And I would say that anyone who says this team is flawed, 100% right. It is flawed, but...
Every team's flawed.
Right. Yeah. You know, with... I'm not sure that the Cubs have an obvious flaw, to be honest. But I think that you look
Jason at... Hayward?
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
you can put holes in 18.
But Hayward's still a good player. I mean, if that's your flaw, and he's an elite defender, you know, with a history of somewhat okay offensive production.
Not in the last 162 games.
Certainly not recent history. Even the Cubs, you can pick holes on. Last year's Royals, I mean, they did not have great starting pitching. I don't think anyone would say that they did, and yet they won the World Series. So I think that this team does have flaws. They definitely have a lot of work to do this offseason, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot about that in the weeks to come. But, you know, the reality is they still had a lot of talent, and that starting pitching that carried them so far in the regular season actually did its job in the playoffs. I mean, they were basically... Was there even one game where they didn't have good starting pitching?
I can't think of one.
I don't think they did. I think they were essentially good every single time.
Yeah, I mean, you can maybe pick on Marcus Stroman in game 3 of the ALCS.
Or Sanchez, I guess, in the clinching game of the division series.
Yeah, right.
When he allowed 5 earned runs, but...
Yeah, but other than that, man. Yeah. Like, but that's also, like, we're kind of searching for faults, right?
Yeah.
Like, Stroman in that game, that I'm talking about 5 1/3, 4 earned runs, right? Like, not phenomenal, but also, like, you know... Better than Colby Lewis.
Yep.
Better than, you know, Ryan Merritt should have been. Like, that's the ultimate kicker of this thing, is that Ryan Merritt beat the Blue Jays.
Sure did.
You know what I mean? Like, that's really, as soon as he got through 4, basically, it was over, because you had Andrew Miller. Andrew Miller last night got like 8 outs on 21 pitches.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That is insane. You know, like Brian Shaw looked phenomenal. Like, just a wicked, wicked breaking ball, you know? Cody Allen was really strong in this series. Once Terry Francona could go to his bullpen, it was over.
Right. And last year, you know, the season ended at the hands of Wade Davis, and that's kind of what you're conditioned to expect, right? Some sort of dominant pitcher shutting you down. And then this year, in the deciding game, you have Ryan Merritt out there. I mean, really? This is the guy who's going to shut down this offense that for so long looked like a force of nature?
The other thing is, everything that Terry Francona did in this series worked out.
Almost
everything. Yeah. Not the walk of Josh Donaldson to get to Edwin Encarnacion.
Yeah.
But, like, okay, a 5-game series, we could find one thing he flubbed.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Oh, he was great.
It's like, it kind of, I do think he's managed well, but I do think that, you know, good results can make a manager look better than he is, right? Like, sometimes managers make the perfect move or the ideal move for the situation, and it blows up in their face. And sometimes, you know, managers just kind of like, I don't know, just like throw a dart at the lineup card and pick a guy, and you know what I mean? Like, and it works out.
Yeah.
But everything Terry Francona did in this series just was gold.
Yeah. Well, you know, you ask John Gibbons, what's the key to good bullpen management? And, you know, he's going to say good relievers. That's, you know, that's yeah, what totally. Makes you look good as a manager. And I think there's a lot to that here. Not every team is deep enough where you can have multiple elite type relievers, if we're going to include Allen in that. Yeah. And so Cleveland was able to do that. And Francona, I think, had great pitching and he used it expertly. I mean, this is the best of both worlds where you have really, really good pitching and you have a manager who's just pushing the buttons at the exact right time.
You look at how he got through the Bauer game. And that was the most impressive one to me because he got two outs out of Trevor Bauer. And then Trevor Bauer had to leave. And he went to his bullpen and he had six pitchers come in. And all six pitchers pitched in two innings, but none of them pitched for two innings, which kept changing up the look that the Blue Jays were getting, kept his bullpen fresh for the next day because there was going to be a next day. And that was in game three. So I knew there was two games, like there was no off day for 2 days. Like that was really masterful, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. You know, you look at 25 outs. Yeah. It's a lot of outs to try to get from your relievers. I mean, sometimes you need 3, 4, 5 outs.
Yeah.
25 outs he had to get. And he didn't have, like you were saying, the benefit of an off day, which you so often have in the playoffs. I mean, that was the first of three here in Toronto.
And it's not even like, you know, I think a lot of people would have just said, well, you could turn it over to Andrew Miller for three innings. Andrew Miller closed that game. He got the final four outs. It was probably the shortest appearance Andrew Miller has had in the postseason, I would wager. He got four outs in that game where you would think that you would need to use Andrew Miller even more. You know, like so much of what Francona did this year, and he can do it because he has pitchers who are willing to, has just bucked convention.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. I think that managers seem to be managing much differently in the playoffs than they do in the regular season, which is smart. I mean, that's what you should do. The stakes are higher. The conditions are different as far as the way your roster is set up, as far as the number of off days that you have. And I think for a long time, we saw managers manage pretty similarly. And now I think that we're seeing a pretty big difference. And I think there's no going back. I mean, in the regular season, certainly, you're going to see a return to, I think, normalcy next year. You have to. But I think that this is the new normal for the playoffs, where you're just going to see relievers used in leverage moments. You're going to see them used for extended periods. And I think the role of the starting pitcher might diminish game to game, where you ask them for five innings more often than you ask them for seven.
Yeah, because, you know, was like Ryan Merritt, it worked out. Was he the starting pitcher or was he just the first pitcher to get the ball, right? Like that's kind of what he was, because I imagine if he had gone through the first two innings and then been shaky in the third, like it was clear Terry Francona lifted him after like his second hit or something. Like it was like, bang, like get, you're out, right? Because he wasn't messing around with it. So if that had happened in the second or third inning, Terry Francona might have gone to his bullpen earlier. It's kind of different.
Yeah, and it's the way that teams are building playoff rosters now. They're so pitching heavy. I mean, we saw in the division series, the Blue Jays carried Scott Feldman and Aaron Loop. And you just have all these arms around. You know, Danny Barnes ended up on that roster as well, replacing Liriano.
Yeah, he did.
So you just have all these arms everywhere, and it's a new look where you are able to ask for more because you have other guys who are there as insurance policies.
It's funny to think back about all the things that we like thought a lot about and talked a lot about, like, you know, the inclusion of Dalton Pompey, you know, Scott Feldman, Aaron Loop, Francisco Liriano, like all this stuff that we like were so consumed with, none of it played out.
Yeah.
None of that happened.
Well, so often it just comes down to the basics, right? Like if you're a team that's supposed to hit home runs and you don't hit home runs, you're not going to win those games. And that's kind of it. I mean, it's a painful reality to face. I don't think that it's an indictment of the way the Blue Jays were built. I don't think that it's a sign that this team, you know, can't win. I think this is a team that did a lot. I mean, this is a team that accomplished a lot this year. They won 89 games. They won a wild card game. They're in the playoffs. They won a playoff series. They had three champagne celebrations in an 8-day span. They accomplished a lot. And then they ran into a team that was playing better than them.
Absolutely. Even the supposed, you know, Cleveland advantage of base running and base stealing. Cleveland stole two bases in the series. It really wasn't a factor. Like, credit to Russell Martin, who before the series was like, let's talk about after. Let's see if they do it. And Cleveland didn't, you know what I mean? Like, everybody was writing about how Cleveland's got great team speed. The Blue Jays can't throw out base runners.
Everybody, as if you didn't do it.
I am part of everybody. Yeah. And it wasn't a factor. What was a factor, I thought, was the approach that Cleveland's pitching staff had to the Blue Jays. You could see a very clear trend of breaking ball after breaking ball. No, you know, you look at Kluber's start in game one. He threw more curveballs than he had. Or sorry, more sliders than he had in a long, long time. Josh Tomlin, curveball after curveball after curveball. I mean, it was clear that that's what, you know, it was throw them soft stuff. Don't give them heaters. And that, you know, that's great if you can throw your soft stuff for strikes, which Cleveland did. And the other trend you really noticed was staying away from the right-handers and not pitching them in, you know, not pitching them inside. Like so many teams this year, the strategy they took with the Blue Jays right-handers to kind of take that pull power away from them was to pitch them like super inside and back them off the plate and make them move their feet and make them uncomfortable. Cleveland was like, well, why don't we just use the outer half of the plate? Just pitch them away all day. And these guys will, you know, try to get these guys to chase, and they did.
Yeah, worked out really nicely. They've got a lot of pretty good pitchers. And you know, I still think they're going to go into the World Series probably as the underdog, whether it's the Dodgers or the Cubs, but they've gotten this far. I mean, winning the American League isn't nothing, even if they lose. And hey, it's once you're in the World Series, anything can happen too.
Yeah, you got a team going into the World Series that's coming off of a 5-game ALCS when they hit 168 as a team and OBP 215.
Yeah, they've like, they've lost only one game in October.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, they're playing well.
They're just pitching tremendously.
Yeah,
they're just pitching, and it, you know, pitching wins you ball games.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. And it did. All right, we're going to step away, take a quick break. But when we come back, there's still much to discuss, such as the futures of Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, some of the other pending free agents around the roster, and you know, just what this offseason might look like. All that and so much more when we come back on At The Letters.
There's never any disrespect meant. I simply gave my opinion on what I thought could have happened. I never said that he wasn't good enough. Obviously, he's here, and the little experience he had before tonight, he had pitched well. So, and I also stated that those type of matchups can go either way.
It continues on At The Letters. Arden's Welling with Ben Nicholson Smith. We're on sportsa.ca. We're on iTunes. We're also on Twitter. I'm at Arden's Welling. Ben's at B Nicholson Smith. You can engage with him and let him know all your thoughts about Jose Bautista there.
Yeah, there were quite a few thoughts streaming into my Twitter account after I tweeted Bautista's comments about Ryan Merritt.
And the Cleveland Indians official Twitter account, which would not afraid to mix it up, that Twitter account, by the way, whoever runs it, decided to retweet Ben, which made his Twitter basically, you just can't even look at it at that point. Like, you can't even look at your mentions. It's insane.
The comments are pretty entertaining. I mean, it's like a whole world unto itself, the comments of that tweet.
Our producer, Sam McKee, also on Twitter, at Sam A. McKee. You can get at him with your spicy Leafs takes. He loves that. It was just a great night for Sam yesterday when he got home to watch the Leafs game. They're up, what, like 4-1 in the third? And
4-0, I think it was.
4-0 in the third, was it? And then all I saw was in OT, Austin Matthews gets a breakaway, stoned, Patrick Laine goes back up the ice, just crushes Sam's dreams and hopes.
Yeah, it was a rough day for Toronto sports yesterday.
Seriously, yeah, it was pretty rough. But you know what? It's a rough time as not, right? Because the Blue Jays, back-to-back ALCS. Raptors have been deep into the playoffs repeatedly. They went to the Eastern Conference Finals. You know, like, there's a lot of success right now, at least more than there has been in quite a while.
Yeah.
Not that this is the thing we talk about on this podcast, but, you know.
No, it has for sure. And I think that, you know, to zoom in on the Jays particularly, I think they had a successful season. You know,
me too.
You know, not that they need me to say it, but I think they did.
They were a good team and they did well.
Yeah.
Really, you know, and if I had told you in 2014, hey, you're about to get back-to-back ALCS appearances, you'd take that. You'd be like, hey, I haven't had that in 22 years.
Right. You know? Even at the beginning of this year, when we'll get to our full over-unders at some point.
Oh, yeah.
In the coming weeks, that'll be fun.
I feel like those didn't work out well for me this year.
Oh, yeah.
I have a feeling.
Spoiler alert. We'll see where
Josh
that
Josh Tolley didn't hit another home run.
He did not. That much is true. Yeah. No more homers for Josh Tolley. after that. What was it? Opening day or like second day of the season? He hit an early home run.
It was off Drew Smyly, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And I was like, you got to hit another one, Josh. Nope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, were you making a point there?
Yeah. Over-unders.
I don't know. You were going to say something. Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah, no, look, they, you know, I do. I think there is a good portion of the fan base who did enjoy it and did remember the moment.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
And it's hard to do at the very moment that that's happening. Where I was going with that was that at the beginning of the season, we set the over-under for playoff wins. And I think we set it at something like, or ALCS wins, I think we set at 0.5. And they won an ALCS game.
We would have made it ALCS games, right?
Or games, just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and they got back there. You know what? Like, not even a month ago, as the season was winding down, it was kind of like, oh, like, is this team going to miss the playoffs? Like, are these guys actually going to blow it? Like, they're blowing it right now. And, you know, there was a lot of consternation then. And then, you know, all of a sudden, teams in the ALCS, one of the last four teams playing.
Yeah. And that's not an easy thing to do. It's a tough thing to appreciate right after your team is eliminated and they win one game out of five. But I think that, you know, in the next few weeks, it'll be a little easier to appreciate the fact that this team did a lot of things right in the course of this season.
Yes. Looking ahead, I don't think that it is too much of a take to say that this will be a very different looking team next year. There's going to be a lot of moving parts. But let's actually start with a guy who will be back next year, manager John Gibbons. Mark Shapiro confirming to basically anybody that asks him that John Gibbons will be back next year. I think it is deserved. You know, there was a part of me where as the season went, like that period I was just talking about, where it's like, oh my God, are they going to blow it? Where I was like, I just hope the Jays make it deep enough so that John Gibbons gets to keep his job, right? Because I enjoy him and I think he's a good manager. But yeah, you know, you go to the LCS in back-to-back years, you should get to keep your job.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think that, you know, it's a bit of a different feel with this new front office. I mean, that's pretty clear compared to Alex Anthopoulos, who had a long history with John Gibbons. Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins didn't have a long history with him. And so I think a lot of people assumed that they were going to let him go at the first possible moment they could. And every manager gets fired eventually, and I'm sure that it's not lost on John Gibbons that that'll eventually happen to him. But this is a front office that I think has liked what they've seen from him. And so they are supporting him now because as much as he's an old school guy, I think that everyone adapts in this game. And guys like Ned Yost and Terry Francona, who are old school in their own right and, you know, personal friends of John Gibbons, we've seen them adapt. And I think that we're seeing Gibbons adapt in some ways as well, where he's not necessarily going to be that, you know, old school guy in the way that he manages all the time. I think that he's going to be open to different strategies, and he is open to different strategies, even though on a day-to-day personal level, he's still his same self.
I think that, yeah, it's always weird when it's a forced marriage, right? Which is what it was with John Gibbons and this front office. But I think John Gibbons really proved himself this year with, like, you think about the clubhouse this guy has, you think about the personalities in there, right? Like, you know, like Josh Donaldson, huge personality. Jose Bautista, one of the biggest personalities in the game. Troy Tulowitzki, who is like so insanely intense. And then you've got, you know, the young players on this team, like Aaron Sanchez, Marcus Stroman, Roberto Osuna. You're trying to, you know, you're trying to manage the big personalities. You're trying to groom your young players. You're trying to make everything harmonious. Like, I think John Gibbons did a really good job of managing all, you know, quite a crazy diverse array of players, really.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
Yeah. And a lot of guys who are established and have expectations and having to juggle those different personalities in the course of the year, make sense of a bullpen that for the most part was never steady, even when they were pitching well. I mean, there was a period in August where they were pitching really well and you thought, okay, maybe they finally found some answers here. But then later in the season, you have Benoit go down and you have Liriano hit in the head with a line drive. And early in the season, they had no answers in the bullpen. I mean, Drew Storen was the setup man for how long on this team?
Oh, my God.
So he, really, you know, with the bullpen in particular, he did a good job. The Aaron Sanchez situation was, you know, an ongoing question that he dealt with.
That was a difficult thing to deal with.
Right. Yeah. I think the one thing with Gibby that you get is he's the same guy day to day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, the consistency is off the charts.
Yeah.
There's never panic. There's rarely frustration. Like occasionally, immediately after a game, you might see a hint of frustration, but even not that much. You think about even, you know, the Chris Colabello situation. That was a thing that, you know, the fell at his feet in some ways, you know, like there was a lot of as there is with any, you know, with any team in any season.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of work for the manager to do. I thought he did a good job. Deserves to be back. Two players or two individuals, I guess, who I feel will not be back are Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion.
Yep.
Edwin Encarnacion, because I think the Blue Jays are just like the market will just take him away.
Yeah.
For what he's going to get on the open market. Jose Bautista, because I just don't believe the Blue Jays want to carry on with him.
Yeah.
It's my opinion.
So why don't you elaborate on that? Why is it, you know, that for a player who a year ago this time was seen as a vital piece to their ongoing success, why do you think that they might be comfortable parting with him?
Thank you for carrying me while I just died a small death off mic. You know, it's obviously a complicated history with Jose Bautista, but you know, Jose really, he made his name in this city. He's done a lot for this franchise. If they've even had extensive conversations about what an extension would look like or what it would take, I don't even know how far those conversations have gone. I doubt they've even gone that far. But if they have, like, I doubt they've been very harmonious. I doubt there's been much common ground. There's been much mutual thought. So I think, you know, the team's just kind of saying, like, hey, look, if this is what you want, this is what it's going to take, go out there. Go get it. Go see if you can get it, because we're not going to give it to you.
Yeah, and with both of these guys, they've played for so long in their careers and hit 300 home runs plus each of them. And now this is, you know, their first chance to hit free agency as established stars. And it's going to be interesting. It's going to be their chance to see how the other 29 teams value them after, in Encarnacion's case, a phenomenal season. In Bautista's case, a season that he admits, you know, wasn't the one he set out to have as far as knee and toe injuries and, you know, hitting 22 home runs and probably a, you know, somewhat productive but not exceptionally productive season. Right. And now they're gonna see how other teams value them.
No, I think the Bautista one's gonna be really interesting to watch and just to observe just and see how his free agency plays out. I think Edwin's gonna get a really big deal. I think it's gonna be from the Boston Red Sox, but who knows, there could be other players.
Rangers are an interesting possibility that Shai Davidi mentioned.
Yeah, for sure. They'd be interesting for, I mean, they couldn't do it, I don't think, but they'd be interesting for Jose Bautista. Yeah, I don't think they could do it now.
I don't think he's going to be lining up next to Rougned Odor on opening day 2017.
But yeah, you know, I bet you Edwin will get a 5-year offer somewhere.
Yeah.
After what he's done.
Well, you think about
a lot of money.
You look at what he's done and his age, he's 33, right?
Yes.
So Encarnacion is going to have a lot of teams, I think, in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So then I think to get him, you have to go to 5. Yeah. And the expectation, just from asking around a few people in the industry, I think that it's a given that he's a $20+ million player. And then the question is, how far above 20 do you get on a per year basis?
Yeah.
Is it 25? Is it more than that even? Is it somewhere in between? And then you start multiplying, let's say 25 times 4 years times 5 years. You're talking about a big number. And you know, it's a contract that it's going to be deserved. I mean, he's a really productive player. He's a middle of the order bat, and he's coming off yet another productive season. A lot of teams are going to want this guy.
I think Dave Dombrowski's just going to buy him out. Just going to bully offer, say, hey, 5 years, whatever. What, 140, 145, what do you want? Let's get it done. That's what I see happen.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Speculating.
And, you know, both these guys are going to be linked to draft picks. They're both going to receive and decline qualifying offers.
Yes, and absolutely.
But like you said, Dombrowski's someone who likes stars. He's someone who is tasked with replacing the best DH of all time. Mm-hmm. And I think that the idea of seeing Edwin hit balls off the Green Monster is a pretty intriguing one.
He's going to put dents in that thing for like 4 years, five years. What about a market for Jose? It seems like probably AL only at this point. It'd be interesting to see if someone tried him to move him to first base. I don't know how much more time he has as an outfielder, but I don't know. Carlos Beltran played right field until he was like 40, right? So,
yep.
I don't know. But what do you see the market for Jose being?
I wonder if his representatives try to pitch him as more than an AL only guy. I mean, that's what I would do. I think that when you look at how a lot of these free agents are positioned entering free agency, I mean, you remember last year when Chris Davis hit free agency, Scott Boras is talking him up as an outfielder. And then, of course, he goes back to Baltimore and signs. But I wonder if we hear about Bautista's versatility. You know, he's willing to play different positions just to open up the market for him a little bit. Total speculation there. We'll see where it goes. But, you know, I think the real question is going to be how teams evaluate his bat.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of right-handed power out there. Not a lot of guys with 300 career home runs. But, you know, the question, as always, in free agency, or I shouldn't say as always, the free agency has become not about what you've done in the past, but what you can do going forward. That's why young players get paid a lot. And that's why if you hit free agency at 36, there are going to be questions. So
yeah.
Everyone knows that Bautista is a guy who takes good care of himself. I think there are going to be a lot of teams interested in giving him a multi-year deal at a very generous annual salary. I don't know how many years that leads to. You know, I don't know if, is it three? Is it a different number? I don't know.
You're betting futures with a guy in Jose Bautista who, like, there's a lot of red flags there. Think about trips to the disabled list this year. You think about declining both defense and offense. Think about his age. There's also just what he brings to a clubhouse. He's a huge personality, you know, and you need the right market, the right clubhouse, the right manager, the right situation to you know, allow to just have that be around. So I wonder about, this is just like, I'm just spitballing, but I feel like Jose's free agency is one of those that'll go deep into the winter. Like, he might not sign until right before spring training kind of thing.
And
I wonder.
And that seems to be happening a lot more in baseball than it used to. And sometimes you see that where if a hitter or a player doesn't get the offer that they're looking for, they're willing to wait. And sometimes it actually works. I mean, and we've seen guys, you know, going back to Prince Fielder and the Tigers, you see guys wait and wait, and then sometimes they end up getting a really generous offer. But I don't know exactly, you know, with Encarnacion, you could see it going the other direction where someone comes out and says, well, I think we want you and we're going to be aggressive.
Oh, I think that one will be quick.
Yeah.
I think it'll be, big offer right away. I think Encarnacion will double back to the Jays and say, do you have anything for me? I think the Blue Jays will probably say no, and then he'll go wherever he's going.
Is it a crazy notion that Encarnacion could, I mean, the conversation seems to be around 4 years, 5 years.
Yeah.
Is it crazy to think that he might get six or seven?
I think so, but I don't know.
Maybe. He hit 42 homers last year.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
If you represent him, I mean, maybe you start the ask there anyway.
Well, yeah, of course. You start as high as you can.
Right? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy, but there are a lot of power hitters, right-handed power hitters out there. Mark Trumbo, Justin Turner, Mike Napoli. But Encarnacion's really good. Really good player.
Absolutely. Two other free agents to keep an eye on, Michael Saunders and Brett Cecil. I'm firmly now in the camp of not qualifying Michael Saunders because I just believe that he'll sign it immediately. And I don't think you want to pay him $17 million next year.
You know, asking around a little bit, I think that the perception has changed. And I think that the industry expectation is that the Blue Jays will not qualify Saunders.
I just don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see where he ends up. He desperately wants to come back to Toronto. I'm not sold that Toronto shares that interest.
Yeah, I think that, you know, and Saunders, really good season, 24 homers. 815 OPS, all-star. Slowed down in the second half. Really good playoffs, by the way.
Yes.
So credit there.
Yes.
He told us a few times last night, I want to come back.
Yeah.
You know.
He's been saying it for months.
Yeah. Yeah. He definitely wants to come back. But like you were saying, I think this is a team that tries to get younger. I do think that his left-handed bat is something the Blue Jays need to find a way to replicate, replace, retain. But at the same time, I think that they need to find a way to get more positional versatility and a bit more defense.
What if Michael Saunders was your DH next year / sometimes outfielder?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? At the right price?
Yeah, at the right price. I mean,
I feel like he would hold up a lot better to a full season because he was very banged up this year, as they all were. But yeah, and you know what? Credit to Michael Saunders. He played.
He did.
Full season, didn't go to the DL. So many injury concerns with a guy like him. But he was clearly beat up, and I think that's why he struggled the way he did in the second half. I wonder if he didn't have to carry as much of an outfield load, maybe he's an all right DH. You're losing Edwin Encarnacion. He's a left-handed bat.
Right. I mean,
why not?
Michael Saunders is a good baseball player, and he's 100% worth having on your team if you can afford him. It's a question of, are you asking him to be a centerpiece? Are you asking him to be, you know, someone who's one of many good offensive pieces on a team, what's the price? I doubt it. I just see him signing somewhere else where he's valued more as like an offensive centerpiece, coming off a 24 homer season. And I just, you know, again, I think the Jays are going to try to get, and this is spitballing, but I think they're going to try to get younger. And I think they need to find guys who can play multiple positions too.
That's fair. But I would, I agree with you. I don't think Michael Saunders is coming back. I would at least have the conversation in my
head
if I'm the Blue Jays about, hey, maybe, you know, maybe we have an answer here, you know, like maybe we have a guy and, you know, he can play left field, right field. He's obviously not a center fielder anymore. Like he was in Seattle. Obviously not. We can DH him. Maybe we can try him at first base.
Sure.
I don't know. Right.
Sure.
Like maybe he can play multiple positions and maybe he can be a nice lefty bat in your lineup. Cause it's clear the Blue Jays want like probably 2-3 lefties for next year's team that aren't here now.
You know what
you're
wouldn't
gonna,
hurt?
Right? And you're going to lose one? You're going to lose Saunders and make that hill that much harder to climb? I don't know.
How about a switch hitter for the Jays? That'd be... I mean, other than smoke, it's not really a weapon that you see.
When's the last time they had an everyday switch hitter?
Reyes.
You know? Yeah, Reyes, right? Yeah, it's, you know, it's been a while. Brett Cecil, I don't think he'll be back. I know you have some opinions on what he might get in free agency.
I sure do. Yeah, it's been a...
Kind of a running argument on the among the Sportsnet baseball writers.
Yeah, exactly. We won't get into the exact specifics, but let's just say that I've become very, very convinced. You know, and I've asked a lot of people about this in the last few weeks. Just how many years Brett Cecil is going to get, and it's a little surprising, I think, at first glance. But the answer that I keep hearing from people is that he won't have trouble getting 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know that he struggled at times this year, but I've become more and more convinced that he's really not going to have trouble landing a 3-year deal. And I think it'd be north of $20 million.
Do you think he gets kind of like a, well, I was going to put like a Tony Sipp thing on him, but Tony Sipp got like 18 or something.
Yeah. I think
so. You think north of 20?
Yeah. I mean, he's worth it, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I never know how to figure out the reliever market, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's so difficult.
Well, here's the thing about the reliever market this year. You have a couple really good relievers, Chapman and Jansen. And those guys are going to clean. I mean, I think those guys could get like 50 to 80 million. Seriously.
It's incredible. For a guy who might throw 60 innings, 70.
Right. But then you look at how valuable they are in the postseason too. I think that those guys are really well positioned. And then you look at the next tier. Especially for lefties. You're looking to add a lefty this year. Okay, you got Boone Logan as a free agent. You got Javier Lopez, who's really not what it used to be at all.
Yeah.
Cecil's kind of the next guy that you would want as a lefty reliever. And you think about how many, like when you're a team setting up your roster, a left-handed reliever is one of the things that you need.
Yeah.
Every team needs those. And the Blue Jays included, by the way. That's a hole for them entering this offseason.
Yeah.
So the number of teams that are going to be bidding on a Brett Cecil potentially really high. And this is someone who's got experience. This is someone that was used in high leverage situations successfully in October, didn't allow a run in 6 playoff appearances this year. I mean, I think his market's going to be really strong.
Did have a very strong postseason. We're right up against it, but very quickly, Ari Dickey, another free agent. I give it a zero chance of him returning to the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah.
We'll see where he ends up. Maybe he gets a deal somewhere in the NL. Maybe he just walks away from the game altogether.
I'd like to see him in the NL. I think it'd be interesting to see what he could do in maybe a bigger park facing pitchers. I think it'd be fun to see from afar. I think Blue Jays fans have certainly seen the cost of having Ari Dickey. It means that you have to carry a Josh Toley. It means that your everyday catcher gets banged up if you use him. But, you know, it's cool having knuckleball pitchers in the game. It is. You know, I don't know if Blue Jays fans want to watch them every 5 days, but I think it'd be fun to watch Ari Dickey in the National League.
I agree with you. We got to run, but we thank you for listening to this post-mortem edition of At the Letters. We're on iTunes. We're on sportsnet.ca. I'm Arden Swelling. That's Ben Nicholson-Smith. Our producer, Sam McKee. We'll talk to you soon, I'm sure. Thanks for coming along with us. This has been At the Letters.